Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Students across the country are already going back to school, not just online, but into buildings that have stood empty since March. And of course, their teachers are waiting for them. But it's still not clear what the risks are for students, teachers, or their families. Here's Anthony Fauci speaking to educators on Facebook Live for the American Federation of Teachers last week.
So in many respects, unfortunately, though this may sound a little scary and harsh, I don't mean it to be that way, is that you're going to be actually part of the experiment of the learning curve of what we need to know. We don't have the total database of knowing what there is to expect.
That's hardly reassuring to teachers. Many of them are saying, not so fast. We don't feel safe going back yet. On the other hand, missing face-to-face, in-person learning brings real risks to students. This hour on Point, we're talking to teachers about the start of the school year, about their concerns and the trade-offs they're willing to make. To start us off, joining us from Boston is Mira Levinson. She's the political philosopher focused on civic education, youth empowerment, racial justice, and educational ethics. She's a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and author of several books, including Democratic Discord in Schools, Cases and Commentaries in Educational Ethics, and No Citizen Left Behind. She's also the co-author of a recent paper in the New England Journal of Medicine about reopening schools during the pandemic, as well as a former middle school teacher in the Atlanta and Boston public schools. Mira Levinson, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Anthony.
It's really good to have you. Let me start with just a really basic question. As you think about schools reopening, and from the perspective of teachers, what's your biggest concern?
That neither teachers nor students nor the families who they go home to will be safe when they return, right? I mean, that the virus will spread because of inadequate controls over community transmission, inadequate testing, and inadequate support for contact tracing and for supported isolation.
Right. Right. So is it, I mean, I know that it's going to vary school district, state to state, even city to city, town to town. But in general, do you have a sense that we're just not ready for this?
I think the point that it varies is a really important one, right? So there are 98,000 public schools, more or less, in the United States, over 15,000 school districts in the United States. And as we know, an enormous array of levels of community transmission around the United States. As a nation, are we ready for this? No. Is any one state ready for this? No. But are there potentially actually, thousands of districts and schools that may be ready for this? I think possibly. Depending on levels of community transmission, depending, frankly, on levels of trust among the school board members, the district level administration, the parents, the mayor, the city councilor, the teachers, the students themselves, if they've been working together and if community transmission is low, they may be ready. And in part, they may be ready because they may have been planning for a long time, in fact, how to only partially reopen, or perhaps to reopening only for primary school students who, it does seem, have lower levels of transmission and perhaps susceptibility, and certainly much lower levels of illness than others. So I don't think that there's any one answer we can give for the country as a whole that applies to all of the schools around the country.
It just seems like such, I mean, there's so many incredibly difficult challenges related to the pandemic, beginning obviously with the tragic loss of so many lives. But once you get past that and talk about all the sort of, I don't know, secondary or tertiary challenges, this one seems so vexing because, of course, the safety of kids, families, teachers is got to be of paramount importance. On the other hand, we know as well that there's risk associated with kids not being in school, not getting face-to-face learning. So it seems like such a difficult balancing act as we move toward later this month in August when more schools are set to open. How do you think about that incredibly difficult balancing act?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right. There's nothing easy about this. I mean, the primary way I think about this, frankly, is anger, right? We had the capacity, and we still have the capacity, not to force these wicked choices, mm-hmm. right, between kids and families and society's lack of well-being, the harm that is going to come to them if we keep kids home, and the risk that kids and teachers and their families face if they return to school, right? Almost every other industrialized country around the world has figured out how to reopen schools by getting community transmission down. And we could be in that number, right? So there's nothing medically or scientifically inevitable about the choice that we face. But given that we're here, I think that part of the reason this is so hard is because we are trying to weigh known risks against unknown risks. We know what kinds of losses kids are facing by staying out of school. We know that hunger is increasing, that many, many children and families are not gaining access to the food that they are actually legally entitled to. We know that they're not getting the medical services and the therapeutic services they need. We know that they aren't having eyes on them to see if they're suffering from neglect or abuse. And we know that they're not getting the learning that they need. And a whole bunch of especially urban schools serving predominantly low-income kids of color, and in a number of rural schools that serve kids scattered around areas that often don't have internet service at all, we know that in some cases, up to 20% of kids simply stopped being educated when schools closed in March, right? So those are all the known risks. And then we face the absolute unknown of what will happen to teachers and kids if they go back to school, right? We don't know if they go back. Now, we do know what would happen if they go back with absolutely no personal protective equipment, with crowded classrooms, with closed windows, lack of ventilation, right? That's going to be bad, and we shouldn't do that. What we don't know is what will happen if they go back to schools with masks on, with HEPA filters that are replacing the air frequently, with meals that are served, with smaller classes, with, you know, pods that travel together, right? We don't know because we are the only country in the world that would be trying to reopen schools at the levels of community transmission that we have. But the hard thing is we also really do know that kids are suffering enormously by having the schools closed. And that's, I think, what makes this such a hard problem.
Right. It seemed like at the beginning of that answer, what you were really describing, what we're facing in this country is really a public health failure, which has made this whole set of decisions around how to open schools safely so much more complicated. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I have to say, you know, schools basically are always in this position, right? We look to schools essentially to solve every social problem that has been created often elsewhere in society, right? Their schools are supposed to solve the problem of poverty, solve the problem of child hunger, solve the problem of, you know, the achievement gap, right? Like there are all of these challenges that we construct elsewhere in society because, say, we don't have a living wage, or because we don't have universal access to primary health care, or because we have the ongoing history of redlining and segregation, right? There are so many things that create the challenges that then schools are called on to address. And then, frankly, we tend to underfund schools and undervalue teachers and then yell at them and ask them why they're not, you know, creating the perfect society that we expect them to. So in some ways, this is not a new challenge for schools, is to try to, is to be faced with dealing with the mess that has been created elsewhere, in this case, by inadequate public health responses. The problem is here, we are asking teachers and kids and families potentially to put their lives on the line. Mm. For this.
Well, speaking of putting their lives on the line, we talk a lot during the pandemic about essential workers, and essential workers include nurses, doctors, other first responders, to grocery clerks. Teachers, too, are essential workers. But how do we need to think about educators? How are educators different than other essential workers?
This is a really good question, Anthony, because I find this really interesting. So in some ways, teachers are this interesting midpoint between somebody like grocery store workers and healthcare aides, like on the one hand, and doctors on the other. So who, say, can practice telemedicine, right? So grocery store workers and home healthcare aides, we recognize, cannot do their jobs from home. They have to go in. They also are not people who signed up for a life-threatening job, right? And because we, frankly, tend to disvalue people who are in service industries in this country, our response to grocery store workers and to home healthcare aides who say, you know, why are you making me go in without adequate, you know, protective equipment, without hazard pay, et cetera, is to say, if you don't like it, quit, right? We can find somebody else.
Right.
With teachers, they're in this other side where they have the professional standing. We can't replace them as easily, and they can do some of their work at home, but they can't do the work at home as well as they can do it in school.
Mira Levinson, I'm going to jump in here because we're coming up against a break, but important thought. Hold it. We'll pick it up after the break. We're hearing from teachers. We're going to hear from a whole bunch more throughout this hour about the start of a new school year during the coronavirus pandemic. My guest is Mira Levinson. She's political philosopher, professor at Harvard Graduate School of Education. I'm Anthony Brooks. Stay with us. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking with teachers about the tough decisions they face as schools start back up. Emily from Michigan left us a voicemail. She's a teacher and the founder of the organization Teaching Saves Lives.
I designed a campaign a couple of years ago with a colleague about school shootings. And we made shirts that read, "I don't want to die at school." Unfortunately, those shirts are now applicable to the situation we face as educators today. It's a pretty dark time for teachers. I love my students very, very much, and I wish I could be face-to-face with them, but I am too afraid and too scared to venture into the classroom at this point.
That's Emily from Michigan, a teacher in Michigan. She went on to say that she trusts the leadership in her district, but isn't sure how many other teachers can say the same thing.
I'm hoping that my district will make helpful choices that allow us to stay safe. I have a lot of confidence in my school board and confidence in my administration. But I know I'm unusual in that. A lot of teachers don't feel supported by the people that are supposed to lead them.
And I'm here with Mira Levinson. She's an educational ethicist and professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And Mira, before the break, you were making a really important point about the question of thinking of teachers as essential workers and what that means.
Yes, thanks, Anthony. I think we all recognize that teachers, or we should, are essential workers. And the question, I think, is what does their essential work consist of? And how do they achieve it, right? So what we heard, a part of what we expect teachers to be doing, because it's been a feminized profession for so many decades, is to love their students, right? Emily made sure to say that. I love my students. I love my kids. I care for them. And part of the question is, where do we expect that care to take them, right? Do we expect them, say, to be willing to die for their kids or not? And then on the flip side, how much can they accomplish, say, if they are trying to teach from home remotely versus if they are in the classroom? In some districts, with some families who have access to high quality internet, who have access to hotspots, to one device per kid, whose kids are old enough to be able to actually interact with other people remotely, who have the executive functioning skills in order to be able to follow through on multi-step directions, right, when they don't have an adult around with them, et cetera. The teachers may be able to do quite a good job of teaching kids remotely, and those kids may be able to do a good job of learning and feeling respected and cared for and so forth. For younger kids, for kids who need certain kinds of assistive technologies, who don't actually have access to a reliable device or reliable internet access, who need the one-on-one relationships, et cetera, then teachers probably can't do their essential work from home. And that doesn't mean that I'm saying, and so therefore necessarily send them back to the schools if community transmission is out of control. But it does mean we would be sacrificing children for the sake of the health of the community, which may be the point that we're in for many communities, but that's not a point we should be in.
Right. Boy, what a sad and difficult state of affairs. Mira, stand by, because throughout the hour, we're going to be hearing from a few teachers across the country. And we're going to start with Katie Eagle. She's a second grade teacher at Deer Park Elementary in Deer Park, Washington. Katie, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
So if I understand correctly, your district hasn't decided yet to start the year with full remote learning. Tell us a little bit about what your district has decided to do.
Well, we have decided so far to have a blended approach where some children come to the school and work in small groups in our classrooms, like an AABB model, where Monday, Tuesday, half of the kids that choose to come to school would come on those days and every other Friday. And then, of course, all the parents who want to sign up for online education can do that, of which I think a lot will.
I see. So it's sort of a blended approach. There'll be some students, but not all the students, coming in and out throughout the week, but a lot of them still online. How do you feel? Yeah. How do you feel about that approach?
I love it, and I hope we can do it. I'm so excited to get back in the classroom. It offers choice to everybody. Families can choose, and the opportunities are perfect for everybody. So parents that are worried can keep their children at home, and the rest can send them, and we'll have no more than 10 to 12 students at a time in our classroom. And I feel really safe about all the safety precautions that will be met by our district, and I feel like we're really being provided everything we need.
Well, Katie, I'm really glad to hear that. Give us a sense of what kinds of safety approaches are being followed, and what makes you feel so safe about going back into the classroom.
Well, so, everything that you read online about all the safety precautions that should be met will be met. So masks, physical distancing, smaller groups of children, fresh air. We, you know, I'm lucky. We have a newer school building. We can open up the windows. The ventilation system is good. Those are
important.
Everything that needs to be met is being met, you know.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. So one more question for you, Katie, and that is, I'd love to talk to you just a little bit about, get some sense from you about the challenges of teaching second graders all online, which I gather you had to do when things shut down back in March.
Yeah. Well, today's a prime example of, you know, I couldn't get my computer to hook up, and so I'm doing this on my phone, and so frustrating, and, you know, just examples like that. But as far as the children go, they're young, they're little. I liken it to a surgeon trying to tell somebody how to do surgery over the phone, you know. Teaching kids, especially how to read at a young age, is so much of it. They need to be there. The rhythm, the rhyme, the balanced literacy approach, learning from each other, reading together, all of these things, you know, some parents can do. A lot of them want to. A lot of them don't. Children are going to be left with grandparents and a lot of people in a, you know, in a tough spot having to teach them. I think we need to get back. I'm really eager to. I just needed to be a voice and to voice my opinion for teachers that are ready to go back. I think we need to stop talking about dying. Mm. I'm a teacher. I want to go back. I want to get back to the classroom. As long as it's safe, as long as local health officials deem it to be safe, then I say, let's go. Let's make it as safe as we can.
All right.
And
go ahead, Katie. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Finish that thought. I'm sorry.
I'm just very excited to go back, and I hope that we can.
All right. Katie Eagle, second grade teacher at Deer Park Elementary School in Deer Park, Washington. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Mira Levinson still with us. What did you hear, Mira, in Katie's story there? She talked about, I'd love you to comment first on this blended approach where some students will be back throughout the week. There's the option for continued online learning. And of course, Katie dying to get back into the classroom. Dying's a poor choice of word. Eager, I apologize. That was a terrible thing to say. Eager to get back into the classroom.
Yes, no, that is exactly right. And I think that I heard also an immense amount of trust in her school and in her district and sufficient level of resources to help her feel confident in getting back safely, including what my colleague Joseph Allen at the Chan School of Public Health calls healthy buildings, right? So she described that she was in a fairly new building with windows that open and, you know, adequate ventilation and so forth, and that she trusts that, in fact, parents who are trusted to make decisions for their kids will make good ones, and that it will end up in a small enough number of kids that she feels she can interact with safely, which is fabulous, right? I'm also assuming, I don't know what the transmission rates are in Deer Park right now, but I assume that they're sufficiently low that that's another reason that she's feeling fairly confident. I wish that all schools and districts and educators had that same level of trust and of resources. The other thing I actually wish we knew from Katie is who is educating the kids who are staying at home. Because one of the things I've heard a lot from teachers is the concern that they're going to be expected to teach both simultaneously the children who are in class in front of them and the children who are trying to learn remotely. And I don't know, I was an eighth grade teacher for 8 years. I've taught a bunch of teachers. Like, I feel as if I know a fair amount about pedagogy, and I know that teachers have a ton of skills. I don't know how that is going to work effectively. So my sense is also that Katie feels as if she's being given a pedagogical task that's manageable, which is also terrific, but not something that all teachers feel as if they are being faced with.
All right. Well, let's hear from another teacher. Chris Guerreri teaches life skills at Palm Avenue Exceptional Student Center in Jacksonville, Florida. His school is a public special education school, and he shared his concerns about in-person instruction with us last month. And Chris, it's good to have you back on Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you joined our program last month and said that you were considering other options, as in other jobs, if your district required you to start the school year in person. Tell us how you're thinking about that now and what your school district is thinking of doing.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm terrified about going back. The last caller seemed like she was fine with it. Well, here in Florida, where the pandemic is out of control, it's terrifying. And it's surreal as well, because I feel like they know what's going to happen. There's plenty of evidence what's going to happen, yet still they're pushing to get us back into schools. As for me, I'm numb, really. I feel like I've gotten to the point where I'm so scared it's just numb. My wife is terrified. She spent like $800 on school supplies. So we here in Florida are having a different experience from teachers maybe that are in places where the spread isn't as prolific.
Yeah, sure. So are you thinking, Chris, of, you told us the last time we spoke to you that you might be considering other job options. Are you actually thinking about leaving teaching?
Well, here in Florida, we've been doing a lot of actions. We've had car rallies. We've had protests. So I'm going to hold out hope that our school board and superintendent decide to do the right thing. Several districts here in Florida have gone completely online, which is what many of us believe we should do here in Jacksonville. So right now I'm holding out hope, but I have to tell you, each day that hope gets a little bit less and less. And so when children report on August 20th, I can't guarantee I'll be in the classroom.
Oh, boy, Chris. I understand based on what you're saying. I want to ask you about the American Federation of Teachers. I'm not sure if that's your union. That's the second largest teacher union in the country. The AFT said it would support strikes over teacher safety. Is there talk of that where you are?
Well, in Florida, they passed a law in the 60s that says it's illegal for teachers to strike, that if teachers strike, they can lose their jobs, their certificates, even their retirement. But I have to tell you, I've heard the strike word frequently in the last few weeks. People are really scared, and people don't feel they should have to risk their lives. The last caller said that she's anxious to get back, that kids have lost learning. And I agree, virtual learning hasn't been great for a lot of kids. But this is the thing. Can't we make up that last learning time? Can't we extend school into the summer? Can't we create a gap year or a prep year? We can do so many things to make up lost learning time, but there is absolutely nothing we can do to make up lost lives.
Chris, it's a powerful point. Mira Levinson is with us, Chris. And Mira, I'd love, as you've been listening to Chris, and this should have occurred to me when we were talking to Katie Eagle, I'd love to know what you want to ask Chris.
I'm curious, I hear the pain and fear in your voice, which I'm so sympathetic to. And I'm curious, is there a movement among teachers or in your community just to say, look, shut the place down? If we're going, my husband was talking to a friend last night who said, if the schools have to be closed, no white collar business should be open, right? There should not be a single office building that is allowed to be open if we are forced to close our schools. And I'm wondering to what extent, since you can't strike, can educators organize with others and say, if we have to be shut down, we need to shut the society down?
What do you think, Chris? Yeah, go ahead.
We're what's called phase two in Jacksonville, and phase one is when we were shut down. What we've been trying to encourage the mayor is to move schools back to phase one, because we know what's going to happen, that people are going to get exposed, people are going to get sick, and worse things. And plus, schools will close, which will exacerbate what's happening right now. As for shutting everything down, I can't say that's a terrible plan, especially if it keeps people safe and it slows the pandemic and if it makes sure that everybody can get back safer. So that's a hard call. I'm more interested in keeping schools safe, but if we have to shut society down to keep things safe, maybe we should. When we closed schools in the spring, we were experiencing about 45 cases a day. Right now, we're experiencing 700 cases a day in my hometown.
Astounding. Chris Guerrieri, he teaches life skills at Palm Avenue Exceptional Student Center in Jacksonville, Florida. Chris, thanks so much for joining us, and I wish you all the luck in the world and all of your fellow teachers as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mira, one thing I wanted to ask you about, Chris talked about one idea, that it's not a sort of all or nothing proposition here, that there's the possibility to extend the educational year and make up for the lost learning. What about that?
I think part of the question, I mean, we don't know when it's going to be, you know, like when it's going to be safe to extend to, right? Like when will, I think the basic thing is we have to be willing to lower community transmission so that it becomes safe to open schools. Until we are serious about that, we can imagine reopening schools and keeping them open longer, et cetera. I mean, in the spring when we shut schools down, a bunch of the conversation was about then opening up summer schools and letting kids, you know, regain lost learning then, maybe opening up districts early, you know, a few weeks early, right? We're now talking about delaying district openings, right? Precisely because of the changes in case numbers that Chris was talking about. So I think really, before we start imagining what kinds of things schools might be able to do in person with kids in the future to remediate lost learning, what we really need to do is focus on getting transmission under control sufficiently now so that schools can eventually reopen safely everywhere.
Yeah, and that certainly didn't seem like that was happening in Jacksonville by any stretch of the imagination, as we heard from Chris Guerrieri, with the number of infections that are happening on a daily basis right now. We are hearing from teachers this hour and the dilemmas they face as a new school year dawns amid the pandemic, and many are expected to return to the classroom. And I'm here with Mira Levinson. She's a political philosopher focused on civic education, youth empowerment, racial justice, and educational ethics at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. We're going to have a lot more from teachers when we return. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking to teachers about their concerns about going back to school during the pandemic. I'm here with Mira Levinson. She's professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and an expert in educational ethics. And joining us now from Chicago is Quentin Washington. He's a music teacher at the Sadlowski Elementary School. And Quentin Washington, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm well, and I hope you're well, too. Now, Quentin, do I have it right that the Sadlowski is fully online or will be fully online when students return? Do I have that right?
Well, that's up to the district. So whatever Chicago Public Schools decide will impact Sadlowski and all of our schools. Currently, the plan is to go back into the buildings and possibly some type of a hybrid model for the district, but it's been rather problematic. We had a car caravan yesterday from our CTU headquarters down to City Hall. We had hundreds of cars that participated to protest the idea of opening schools because our union is pushing for remote learning, which it just simply should be. Because we're spiking here in Chicago just as they are down in Florida.
Right.
Not quite as bad yet, but our numbers are climbing.
So what would make you feel safe going back to school? What has to happen? Those numbers have to come down, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. Mainly for me to feel safe, I would feel like they have to have the staffing, the supports that we need. We need equity in our schools. I mean, think about it. For the last 10 years, our union has been advocating for equity for our students and for our families. And that includes having the staffing needs met, the resources for our students so that everyone can feel safe. Things like nurses in every school building every day, you know, which, I mean, most schools barely see a nurse once a week. So if we have real issues, and to someone's point earlier about having those people in the building, I'm a teacher. I'm not a nurse. If there's a kid that's ill, I'm limited in what I can do. And so for me to feel safe going back into a school building, I really feel like we've got to have the trend has to be going downward. And I think that it's hypocritical to close bars and to close restaurants for having, you know, in-person things, but yet you're asking teachers and students to come into buildings and you're exposing families to transmission. And it's particularly alarming to me considering that the vast majority of our students in Chicago Public Schools are Black and Brown students. And we already know that the transmission rates and the mortality rate is significantly higher in that community. Mm-hmm. So that's problematic for me.
Understandably so. Quentin, you're a music teacher, and I'm wondering,
yes,
what are some of the safety concerns that might be sort of particular to your situation as a music teacher?
Well, for example, in my music classroom, I can't have the kids sing because if we're singing, they're producing aerosol, and that aerosol would just be just sitting in the air the entire day. Who's exposed most of that aerosol? Me, because I'm in that room the entire day. Not to mention every other student that steps into the classroom. I can't put the kids on shared instruments because I don't have the time in the day between classes to disinfect every single instrument. So I'm limited in what I can do. There's a lot of things that I would end up doing in my classroom would be things that the kids can do from their desk, experiencing music, making body music, for example, or, you know, we're doing, I don't say paper pencil music, but, you know, musical theory, and then trying to bring that to life of what we're doing physically versus using actual instruments or using our vocal instrument. And that's unfortunate.
Got it.
But a necessary evil.
Well, Quentin Washington, a music teacher at the Sadlowski Elementary School in Chicago, Illinois, thank you for joining us. And good luck to you and to your students and to everyone.
Thank you.
And to everyone at the Sadlowski. Thank you very much. Mira Levinson, I was struck by a number of things that Quentin said. Among them, we close bars and restaurants, but somehow, you know, teachers aren't given the same sort of consideration, especially in communities that Quentin was describing there in Chicago. It's a real concern, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's interesting that Chicago actually has its bars and restaurants closed. Part of the concern, I think, in many places is that we actually haven't closed bars and restaurants, right? And that is the reason that it's so unsafe to go back to schools. I think that if anything, schools are clearly more essential services than bars and restaurants, or gyms or movie theaters or you know, any place that we recreate, we should have all of those closed until it is safe to go back to school. I mean, I was really appreciative of Quentin's creativity as he said, well, you know, if we can't play instruments, we can do body music. And, you know, we can think about music theory and we can figure out how do we embody music from home, which shows that teachers are always thinking, as right, they always are, about how do I help get it across essential knowledge and skills to my students, no matter what the circumstances. And he's also right that this kind of creativity And the risk that teachers and students face is often much more heightened in schools that serve predominantly Black and Brown populations. And so he's right that we need to make sure that they can be safe and that we take seriously the racial disparities in how COVID is spreading and the devastating effects it's having on different communities.
I'm glad you brought up, and I'm glad Quentin brought this up too, this idea of teacher creativity responding to these moments. And, you know, we've heard, and a lot of us, I'm a parent, I understand and witness firsthand how online learning was, you know, really, really limited in what it could do for my 9-year-old son. But in terms of creativity and sort of teachers really rising to that moment. Mira, I'm wondering if you can think of a particular example. I mean, what worked really well or what works really well when teachers are forced to, you know, teach at a distance online? What are the creative approaches that really worked?
I think this kind of gets back to my answer that I gave you at the very beginning when you asked, you know, where are we? And I said, well, there are these 98,000 different schools, right? There are 55 million school-aged children right now in the United States, right? There is no one thing that works for all of them or fails to work for all of them. But there are a number of approaches that if kids have the right supports and so forth can work wonderfully. There's actually a great document that came out a couple weeks ago called Imagining September by a couple colleagues, Joel Maida and Justin Reich, where they conducted design charrettes with educators and school administrators and others around the country. And they have beautiful ideas and examples of what works. Everything from kids coming into the classroom in order to launch a project, to do some of the ideating together, that the relationship building and so forth. And then they go off and they try to enact it on their own when they are home. There are examples from the spring of kids building much deeper relationships with their families and schools connecting with families as they start to conduct oral histories or they explore the source of a favorite recipe and they use that as a way to connect to others in the family, to the history of the family, to also, you know, what is the process of cooking, to the chemistry and the math and so forth of it. There are beautiful examples of letters that were being written back and forth as using literacy skills and taking joy in the art of expression. There are wonderful examples of learning because teachers really are creative beings who draw on their professional knowledge in order to try to help kids grow and develop in a healthy way. But again, the kids need the supports, they need the capacities, they need the resources there in order to access those learning activities.
I want to read a couple of comments from listeners on Twitter. This comes from Darcy. I'm so tired of being expected as an educator to put my life on the line at my job, school shootings, viruses. If I want to have a life-threatening job, I would have chosen a different profession. I care about my kids, but am I willing to die for them? Should I be asked to? And here's BG who writes, I see similarities between teachers and police. We demand that they be responsible for services like mental health care and social work that I suspect was not in their job description. Mira, we're going to go to one more teacher, Syriana Aboud. She's a former pre-K teacher in the Bronx. She's joining us from Cleveland, Ohio. And Syriana, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you so much for having me. I just want to start off quickly by saying I have not seen as many conversations like this happening as should be needed in this country right now. Well, so really, thank you to you for giving teachers a voice.
Well, we appreciate what you do, and we're happy to give you a voice, and thanks for that comment. So if I understand correctly, you were a teacher at preschool in the Bronx. You decided not to return this year. Tell us why not.
So I did not see in March, I did not see a healthy, safe, viable option for returning to school in the fall. Children, I mean, we're learning now more than ever that young children are more efficient at transmitting the disease than we first thought. And in a world before a pandemic, my amazing supportive school could not keep me healthy. I mean, me and all my students, all my families and colleagues, we would be consistently sick from August until January. And this is before a pandemic. So I really did not see any solution being put forth that protected me and the families that I teach.
So what would you have liked to have seen in your district or state? I mean, is there something that your district or state could have done that might have made you feel differently?
Well, so like everybody's been saying, it is really a different case. You have to look at it case by case. But at the same time, in New York City, most of my families were essential workers. My families had to take the subway to get to their homes, their schools, and their work. So just the fact of getting to school, I was already exposed to thousands of people on a daily basis. So in my opinion, there was no safe way to open up schools in the fall. I can't talk about later on. We have to see how the pandemic keeps turning out. But my biggest point is that we had this entire summer and we had from March to prepare for online learning. What happened in March when we left our school, and New York was pretty late to leave. We didn't leave the classroom until mid-March. But really, it was not virtual learning. It was emergency learning. Teachers did not know the difference between Zoom, Google Hangouts, and other resources that were there to help our children. Children did not have access to computers or internet connections that we could have spent this time giving them. And so I think we spent the summer kind of just sitting on our hands, and we waited for policymakers, not teachers, to make the decision. Instead, now I'm seeing a lot of families that don't like the hybrid model, or they don't like the virtual program that's offered by their school, because it is not as prepared as it should be. So now I see a lot of schools and government funds being outsourced to private for-profit companies. So there's all these virtual programs that are coming up where parents aren't paying for them, but public schools are losing funding because of it.
Mm.
I know one example was in Michigan, in a district in Birmingham. They used to have 22,000 students and children enrolled. Now they have 8,000. And a lot of schools get funding per child. So that's a lot of public funding that we're really taking away from children that need it the most.
Mira Levinson, as we listen to Syriana here, I mean, I'm struck by a couple of things. I mean, this idea, you touched on this earlier in the hour, if I'm not mistaken, this idea that we had so much time to really think hard about, how to do online learning right. And we didn't use that time productively.
Yeah, although I would actually, I mean, I'm torn. In part, I'm exactly with Syriana. We had these months. We should have planned to do educating effectively this fall. And on the other hand, we actually wouldn't have had to plan for high-quality online learning if we had taken the pandemic seriously enough and just engaged in public health control measures. Mm. Right? Countries around the world have reopened schools, particularly primary schools, but also middle and high school schools, safely, without exacerbating community transmission, without killing teachers or kids, because they took the public health steps necessary to get the pandemic under control, and they allocated the resources to schools so that they and their kids and their families and the teachers could actually come back to school safely. And so I think that's where we should have spent these lost months.
Mm. I want to ask you both a question. Syriana, stay with us, and Mira as well. So this is from a listener on Facebook, Michael Keating. He asks, I hope you will ask them if they expect to lose their paychecks when they don't work like everyone else. I love teachers in metro school districts. They have a remarkably hard job. But when an entire society is built on the premise of compulsory K-12 education, you can't just pull the rug out from under it and expect there not to be catastrophic dominoes. Syriana, what do you say to our listener, Michael, about that?
Well, Michael, with all respect to your question, I'd like to ask another question that before this pandemic, when teachers were overworked and overqualified for the kind of tasks that we were expected to do, we put in more hours than asked. I mean, I'm a preschool teacher and I was required to get a master's, rightfully, to educate young children, but I was still seen as a babysitter. So I want to ask that before the pandemic, were people asking my paycheck to be increased based on the work I was doing? And then beyond that, when I was doing emergency virtual learning in the springtime, so last year, we were offering 2-hour-long circle time virtual sessions for our children. We had 14 out of 18 children coming up, and we were offering supplementary material on the side. So, and this is at the preschool level, where I only had 18 students.
Hmm.
So I know for a fact that older elementary and high school teachers that have multiple classrooms and multiple hundreds of students, they are putting in more work than ever to offer high quality virtual learning.
Well, Syriana Abood, she's a former pre-K teacher who worked in the Bronx, New York. Syriana, thank you so much for joining us and good luck to you.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Mira Levinson, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank you. She's a professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Mira, it was great having you. Thank you for being such an able guide through this hour.
Thank you so much for having me, Anthony.
We really appreciate it. And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.